everyone, and welcome to the Presumption of Innocence, a podcast brought to you by the White Collar Criminal Defense and Regulatory Compliance Practice at Fox Rothschild. I'm your host, Matt Adams, and today my guest is Morgan McCall Reese. She is my colleague here at the firm and comes to us recently as a seasoned state and federal prosecutor in North Carolina. She joins the Fox Rothschild Greensboro and Raleigh, North Carolina offices with extensive background in defending businesses and individuals in white-collar criminal cases and regulatory proceedings. Morgan, I'm ecstatic to have you part of the practice group and at the firm. And today we really want to touch on your appellate background, because when I say that the Supreme Court and some of our circuit courts out there have really turned some tried and true tested principles of law on their head in recent months and weeks, that's really an understatement, isn't it?
It really is. You know, over the past couple of years, and especially in the past couple months, and, you know, for our purposes of thinking with federal criminal prosecutions and criminal cases and defending those, are our question of how is this affecting the constitutionality of the charges, the cases against our clients, and then how is it affecting sentencing?
Yeah, and the place I think I want to start is right there at sentencing, because, you know, the guidelines and commentary issues in particular have been a topic du jour in light of the Third Circuit's Banks decision a couple of years ago. And that really hit squarely on its head, this concept of intended loss under Section 2B1.1 of the sentencing guidelines, which I would say 9 out of every 10 white-collar cases that I handle, Section 2B1.1 of the guidelines is front and center as the primary driver of the ultimate sentence. And the Third Circuit Banks decision, like I said, turned it on its head. Or did it? Because we're seeing a couple of years under Banks and now sort of a retreat from Banks as the Sentencing Commission has acted in early 2024, set to take place here in just a couple of months in November. So why don't you explain for our audience a little bit about what Banks said and did, and then we can get into how there's now been the retreat from Banks by the commission and what the future might hold for this concept of intended versus actual loss when it comes to the federal sentencing guidelines, which, as we know for our audience, and we've talked about this in the past, when you are a white collar defendant, you are in the guideline. That is the way that you are able to predict and, in many instances, negotiate a better disposition for yourself.
Absolutely. So just stepping back, so Banks deals with what you've already talked about, Matt, which is this calculation of loss. And so when we get someone who is being sentenced under the guidelines and we have to make this determination of what loss their actions, the government is alleging to have caused, we have to look at the guideline. And so you look at the guideline themselves, the policy statement, then there's another part called the commentary, and then even background commentary. So the guideline that we're talking about here defines loss in one way. But the problem is the commentary, until it changes, right, in a couple months, expanded that definition in with this understanding of intended loss. So Banks, back in 2022 in the Third Circuit, really dealt with this issue that has been percolating, which is how do we read the guideline with commentary when the commentary expands the definition of what is in the guideline. So for the loss calculation purposes, if you have someone who is, you know, being held accountable for $1 million, let's just say, in loss, but then the government says, well, no, their scheme actually intended for, you know, $3 million in loss, that affects how the person is going to be calculated their base offense level and then the sentencing guideline range that would be recommended for them, which is an uphill battle. As we know, the higher the guideline range that's recommended, that means you have to ask for a downward variance or a downward departure or something to get them out of the higher range. So as you mentioned, we now find ourselves in this question of how do we read these two together? And this is a reflection on this case called Kaiser that came out a couple years ago, which has now raised into question the deference that we give. And so I'm sure you've seen this playing out in your practice, Matt.
Every day.
Right? And so to your point, what has happened is the Sentencing Commission has now stepped in.
These guys get to say, guess what? A court tried to tell us what we intended. We're going to make our pronouncement of sentencing policy in the United States crystal clear so courts don't have to interpret any more ambiguity, right? So are they effectively reversing Banks now? So we're living in this, I'm practicing in the Third Circuit, and this has definitely come up. It has been black letter law that it, at least since November of 2022, when Banks was decided, we are no longer in this intended loss environment, which has been a cottage industry for forensic accountants and others that are in that business of trying to narrow that aperture with which the concept of loss is seen through. But now the Sentencing Commission has basically said, yeah, we get it. Our guidelines were maybe unclear. The Third Circuit said what it said. But here's what we really mean, and intended loss is back on the table. So talk to us about the rulemaking process now, sort of jumping ahead of the Banks decision to sort of clarify the ambiguities that the Third Circuit discussed.
So let's go back to the basics here, right? So the Sentencing Commission is a judicial agency that's been created by Congress, right? And it's been given certain authorities, the ability to create the guidelines. This all happened back in the 1980s. The guidelines were designed initially, right, as mandatory finding. Of course, that has changed so that they're not in that way anymore. They're just recommendations. They were designed to create this consistency in sentencing. And so that's what the Sentencing Commission's mandate is, to create these guidelines for judges to look at them so that Judge A and Judge B get cases and they sentence defendants similarly.
And in practice, right, in this post-Booker world where the guidelines are no longer mandatory, and we've been in a post-Booker world for more than two decades, but the guidelines are no longer mandatory. Discretion now holds back in the hands of the sentencing courts to determine the sentence. So really all we are is with this aspirational set of guidelines. In practice, I would say 90% of the time, you can take to the bank that you're going to get a guideline sentence, but there are circumstances where judges gladly deviate from that on the upside or the downside.
That's right. That's right.
But now we have this comprehensive body of law that's given us cases like Banks, and these guidelines are supposed to bring uniformity and predictability to a sentence. But you know, the judge still has discretion to throw caution to the wind and throw that out the window entirely. But we're really fighting over what pieces of these guidelines are authoritative and what are not.
That's exactly right.
And so at the end of the day, isn't this just semantics and linguistic games with what is and what is not part of the rule versus an explanatory note?
Well, what appellate decision isn't just about the words and everyone's different interpretation of, you know, the word and or whatever it may be? How can we spend five pages on something as simple as that? But as we know, we can. Because all of this, as you have pointed out, goes back to this concept of the interpretation. You have the text of the guideline that says one thing, but then you look to the commentary or even the background commentary, and somehow it expands the conduct so that your client gets punished at a higher level for something that they have done, because the definition of whatever word gets built out. And so this all comes out of this disagreement in court cases. So we had the Stinson case, which all practitioners are familiar with, which told us that commentary in the guideline manual that interprets or explains a guideline is authoritative unless it violates the Constitution or a federal statute, is inconsistent with or plainly erroneous reading of the guideline. So you have that one interpretation of the authority of the guideline commentary. But then fast forward to within the past 5 years, we have another decision called Kaiser. Kaiser was not about the guideline like Stinson was, but Kaiser told us that just generally when we're talking about agencies, courts do not defer and may not defer to agencies of their own regulation if the court determines that the regulation itself is not ambiguous. So to determine ambiguity, courts have to exhaust the, quote, traditional tools of construction, which to your point, Matt, that goes into the, we're reading the plain language here. How do we interpret the words that are written?
Is this like relying on statutory, when interpreting statutes, relying on legislative history for statutory interpretation?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of different tools that the court uses and that we can use as practitioners to determine whether ambiguity exists in plain meaning. A lot of times you'll see a return to the traditional Latin terminologies, and you have to find tools that are going to help you interpret what the word means. So sometimes, for instance, like you said, legislative history, statutory history in the statutory context will help aid us in the interpretation of something. But here, what we're seeing is this question now that has arisen across the country, and different circuits are taking different approaches about what deference we give to the guideline commentary in these situations where the guideline commentary expands the language of the guideline itself. And so I'll even highlight here in the Fourth Circuit, where I primarily have been practicing, is that we even have a couple of panels who have addressed this question in slightly different ways. You know, whether you look at the Third Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, across the country, courts are issuing rulings about what deference they're giving to the commentary and what analysis, whether they're falling under the Stinson analysis, you know, which relies on Seminole Rock and our deference, or whether they're kind of now starting to adopt Kaiser. And it just depends on how you read the interaction between these cases.
So Banks says application note 3A of the commentary is basically effectively not part of the rule, so we're not going to consider it. Actual loss is the rule in the Third Circuit for 2 years.
Right.
November of 2024, as we fully expect, the Sentencing Commission new rules will take effect. The application note that talked intended loss is now part of the rule, and this whole ordeal is over. But what other sentencing issues do you see on the horizon, if any, that might encounter this same judicial scrutiny that may ultimately result in either the Sentencing Commission going back and taking a look and putting something that was previously part of the commentary into the rule or not? I mean, are there any other sentencing issues that you see out there on the horizon that are ripe for that type of appellate development?
Well, you've seen this happen already, especially in the context of career offender and controlled substance offenses. That's where that litigation has happened a lot already. There may be some instances in the tax guidelines where there may be some expansion of that language. But I really think that for practitioners, the takeaway point is when your client is being sentenced, you calculate the base offense level under the guideline language. If you have to look to the commentary and the commentary exposes your client to a greater sentencing level, a greater offense level, or it expands the conduct, then I think you need to look to your circuit's interpretation of Kaiser and Stinson and the deference we give to the commentary and see if you have the window to make a case.
And I will tell you, this whole issue is fascinating. Last year at the Fox Rothschild White Collar Symposium, we had members of the Sentencing Commission on one of our panels who actually came out and said, we believe Banks will be revisited. We believe that we are going to do exactly what they have ultimately done. And I find this pretty fascinating in articulating in early 2024 the intention to modify this intended loss issue of 2B1.1 in response to Banks. The Sentencing Commission wrote, The commission estimates that approximately one-fifth of individuals sentenced under Section 2B1.1 in fiscal year 2022 were sentenced using intended loss. This estimate is based on the commission's review of a 30% representative sample of 3,811 individuals sentenced under 2B1.1 in fiscal year 2022 with a no non-zero loss amount. Intended loss was used for sentencing in 19.8% of cases in the sample. Using these findings to extrapolate all Section 2B1.1 cases with a loss amount, the commission estimates that approximately 750 individuals were sentenced using intended loss in fiscal year 2022. Of those 750 individuals, approximately 50 were sentenced in the Third Circuit prior to the bank's decision. Now, to me, it's really remarkable because I know that there was a flurry of defendants who were seeking to be resentenced in the Third Circuit in light of that. So these decisions really do have a far-reaching effect, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you think about this, if you're a defendant who was sentenced before bank and your guideline range was bumped up because of the concept of intended loss, and then banks comes out and your total offense level would have been lower without the intended loss, just based on actual loss, then yes, you have to go back in there and argue it. What you just read makes me reflect on the overarching problem that we're having here, which is courts across the country are interpreting a regulation that has been passed by the Sentencing Commission, and they're applying it to defendants' cases. They have now been applying it in such a way that is inconsistent across the country. We have the bank's decision. Then we have other courts that haven't even decided this decision yet, right? Like the Fourth Circuit still has the loss decision outstanding. Of course, is it obsolete now in light of the guidelines changing? I'm not sure. It depends on if they take on the Kaiser and Stinson argument. But the problem is, if the Sentencing Commission was created to avoid unwanted disparities in sentencing, this is exactly now what has happened based upon this problem.
Yeah, so much for consistency.
It's thrown out the window, even within the Third Circuit, to your point, of cases that happened before bank, and then now cases that have happened after banks, and then now cases after November.
Yeah, and it's just a microcosm for just how impactful these appellate decisions really are. And when appellate advocates like yourself are parsing through these constitutional and statutory and regulatory frameworks that form the criminal law, I think unlike any other area of law, we're really a patchwork because we have these various sources of law to draw from. Let's shift away for a moment on guidelines issues, because I think we can at least agree that banks may very well have been put to bed by the Sentencing Commission, but that there are some other areas where banks' style arguments could be made, where commentaries will be decided as either part of the rule or not, and then the commission will either act or not. But this is going to be a give and take, I think, for some time in light of these developing lines of attack on deference versus none. But let's move into some of the other issues du jour that are out there in our appellate world that impact the white-collar criminal defense and regulatory compliance practice, Morgan, especially as it relates in technology. And this concept of geofencing is something that really, really fascinates me. We've been exploring some of these hot button issues on the presumption of innocence in recent episodes, especially as it pertains to artificial intelligence. But what's your understanding of a geofence, and how are the appellate courts tackling this particular issue?
So to your point, Matt, this is an interesting issue, right? Because over time, we have seen technology, of course, come into play with this concept of privacy. So geofences seem to be a very new source that law enforcement agents are using to investigate crimes. let's just start with the basics. What's a geofence, first of all? So a geofence basically is based on someone's location history that they activate within their Google account. And if you have an Android phone, it applies in a certain way, obviously, like logging into your Gmail or your Google account. So geofence warrant, they look for location history and they have the ability to effectively map onto an area the people who were there at the time. So think about this in practical effect. And Shatry is the case out of the Fourth Circuit that was just recently decided that dealt with the Fourth Circuit.
I mean, it's Big Brother on steroids. It's putting people at the scene of a crime potentially based upon their digital fingerprint at that given moment, whether it be from an IP address, whether it's a cell tower, whether it's, you know, all of this remote wireless connectivity that we enjoy in our everyday lives makes our lives easier and better, supposedly.
Right.
I have some arguments on that one, but we'll put those aside for the moment. It's taking all of that information, assembling it, and putting somebody in a particular place.
That's exactly right. So this U.S. versus Shatry case is the example of it. And because this is the only opinion from a federal court of appeals on this issue, there's another one pending in Minnesota right now. But so Shatry involved a bank robbery. And this happened in Virginia. It happened in the late afternoon. And so what the local law enforcement did was they did this geofence search warrant, which effectively allows them to ask Google for the data for anyone who was within this area at this time. And, you know, they draw like a box or however you want to say it, but they draw it around the bank so that they can find the people who have opted into the location history and then are in the area. Now, there are three steps that Google has created to do a geofence, and that's kind of their own self-created procedure. It's not based necessarily in the law. And so law enforcement drawing the area, submitting it to Google through a search warrant, Google providing some anonymized data, law enforcement going through identifying who they want from the anonymized data, sending it back to Google, and then Google eventually sending it back, and then the anonymized data becomes non-anonymized at that point. So what that does is if you and I are at that bank when it's being robbed and we both have location history on, our data is now part of the government search warrant. The government sees, oh, Morgan Race was sitting right there by the bank and there was Matt too.
And yeah. The implication is that maybe combined with other evidence, you were responsible for that bank.
That's right. So, you know, then they see Mr. Shatry there and, you know, for whatever reason, he becomes appealing to them or they know him to be a suspect in other robberies and one thing leads to another. It's the law enforcement describes it as an investigative tool. But really, you know, it is being able to use Big Brother to the benefit of criminal investigation.
I was involved heavily in the post-Carpenter sort of cell phone triangulation. This makes it look like a horse and buggy stuff compared to that. I mean, that was like guess and check. Maybe you're there, maybe you're not.
Right?
But this is some pinpoint stuff.
This is some pinpoint stuff. And here's the problem with where now we are. So the Fourth Circuit took this case. It came out of the Eastern District of Virginia. The Fourth Circuit came out with a decision in July of this year, just basically a month ago. It is a long opinion because it was not a unanimous decision, 2-1. The dissent wrote a very long dissent talking about all the things that we're talking about, which is that this is an invasion of privacy. But here's the whole thing that the Fourth Circuit said. They said this was not a search that implicated the Fourth Amendment. And it rested in large part on the user's ability to opt out of location history, which we don't have to get so far into the technology and the ability. Suffice it to say, based on this opinion and the way the Fourth Circuit saw it, because you have the ability to turn off or say no to location history in your Google account and your Android devices, that really weighed heavily into the court's analysis. They compared it with Carpenter, where you don't have the ability to opt out of that data, right? Because you're carrying your cell phone around and it automatically has to connect to the cell towers. So the court in the Fourth Circuit said, you know, that was a really important distinguishing factor. And they, interestingly enough, the Eastern District of Virginia did not even make this ruling. This was not the ruling that was on appeal. They affirmed for another reason based in the record, which is, you know, it's just interesting. When I saw this case, I thought that they might go to the good faith exemption and kind of avoid this issue altogether, but they didn't, and they took it head on. And now we have this rule that a geofence is not a search that implicates the Fourth Amendment. So, you know, I'm wondering in the Fourth Circuit now, what's law enforcement doing? They don't have to go get search warrants?
All because I have the ability to go on to the settings of my phone and say, I want to turn my location off.
Yep. The way the Fourth Circuit describes the process in here is very in-depth, right? Because it's a very fact-intensive analysis. But you have the ability right up front to say yes or no. And there's some data that the Fourth Circuit cites about the number of people who opt into the service versus opt out. And it's just a...
It's remarkable because I'm thinking through my own cell phone, right? How many times a day do you get your apps asking you if you're sure you want to activate the location service or you're sure you want to turn it off? You know, while you might be able to turn it off, living in the modern environment, the modern technology-driven landscape, there are all kinds of opportunities to have that inadvertently turned back on, even if you elect to turn it off, based on the types of technologies that are being utilized in just our everyday lives. And for the court to ignore that is kind of remarkable. And I think something that ultimately might need to go up to the Supreme Court one of these days.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, so this case is being handled by the Fourth Amendment Center through the NACDL, and they have a wonderful page on their website about Schachtri and about geofence search warrants. So just if anyone's interested, please go check that out. They have all the filings on there, and they also have a lot of the testimony from the district court cases, the district court case that was involved in Schachtri. But I'll tell you this, the window for Schachtri to petition for an en banc hearing in the Fourth Circuit, they asked for an extension. So there's still a possibility that they'll ask for that rehearing en banc. Whether or not the Fourth Circuit grants it, I don't know. But there is litigation to come out of Schachtri. And as I mentioned before, there's also a Minnesota state case that is dealing with this very issue right now. So, you know, the Fourth Circuit doesn't decide it for the country. The Fourth Circuit has made this ruling now for the Fourth Circuit, which may be challenged in an en banc hearing. And, you know, frankly, maybe challenged to your point, Matt, in a couple of years when there's more possibly a circuit split discussion this issue.
Yeah. And big shout outs to the NACDL and the Fourth Amendment Center there. They are really out there on the cutting edge of all of these technology issues and all the various sundry of new surveillance tools that the government is bringing to bear and out there defending individual rights. I am indebted to them. I've worked with them before in other cases. They really are at the cutting edge on these issues. So let's take another pivot away from the circuits, if we will, Morgan, and let's talk about a very active year at the United States Supreme Court, chock full of headline grabbing notable cases, reversals, and all kinds of stuff. We'll keep the politics out of it and keep it straight to the nuts and bolts. But suffice it to say, it was a busy year. Talk to us a little bit about Erlinger, because that was one of the really disruptors that have, one of many disruptors, I guess, that have come out of the Supreme Court in our little area of the practice in the last year.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. So Erlinger is an interesting one, right? So if you are in federal sentencing and you are convicted of certain crime and you have the three predicate offenses that qualify, then all of a sudden your sentencing scheme changes. It goes from a statutory maximum to a statutory minimum of 15 years, and you're facing a much higher punishment, right? Because that's what the whole concept behind the Armed Criminal Act is, to punish those who the government deems to be an armed career criminal. So here's the thing. Over the entire course of the Armed Career Criminal Act and sentencing with it, proving that someone has those three prior predicate offenses has always been a question that's been left to the court. This has now changed our practice. We now have to have a jury decide whether the three predicate convictions were committed on occasions different from one another in order to be sentenced as an armed career criminal. That may not seem like a big deal, but the practical implications of this are now that juries are going to be deciding a lot more than simply guilt or innocence. So if you think about this practically from a practitioner standpoint, who's a criminal defense attorney in a federal district, and you have someone who is an armed career criminal, then yes, of course, you're going to want a jury to decide this issue. You don't want to just concede it. And it's going to draw out a lot of options for people to be able to challenge that, hopefully in a really good way, I think.
Is it going to be more bifurcated trials, do you think?
Oh, yes, for sure, right? Because if you're a defense attorney, I mean, if your client pleads guilty to, let's just say, the gun charge, the 922G charge, but you still want to have a jury trial on this question of whether or not they're an armed career criminal, then yeah, you're going to take that to a jury and you're going to hold the government to its burden there. Which, I mean, makes sense, right? I mean, and that's the whole point of the court at Erlanger, was that, you know, it increases a defendant's punishment in such a way that it has to be found by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. So I think that the questions that I have coming out of Erlanger is something that Kavanaugh says, right? So he says in his opinion, he has a footnote, which says this is not going to be retroactive. There's a line of cases coming out of this. Teague is the old one. And then in 2021, they interpreted another one. The name is escaping me. But he basically suggested that this is not going to implicate any sort of, it's Edwards versus Vannoy. They're going to say that it's not retroactive, so that people who were sentenced, let's just say in 2020, to an armed career criminal sentence, can't challenge it now. Whether that's going to play out in that way, I think that people should probably ask that. Not should, they absolutely should be asking that question for their clients. And they should be thinking about it in the context of post-conviction litigation, whether it the 2255 context and the habeas petitions. They really need to ask that question and they need to make those arguments. And maybe Kavanaugh's footnote in his opinion doesn't bear out.
Fascinating. What else have we seen coming out of the most recent term of the United States Supreme Court? Talk to us a little bit about Loper Bright.
Yeah, so Loper Bright, on its face, doesn't seem like it's going to affect criminal law, right? Because it's about regulatory law. It's about the deference that we're supposed to be giving agency interpretations of their own regulation. But like we were just talking about at the very beginning, Matt, the guidelines are based on a regulatory framework, essentially, right? Because the Sentencing Commission is a judicial agency. It's not your traditional executive agency. It's a little different. But Loper Bright, to me, raises this overall question of deference that we're giving to agencies. And it's really an overall question of administrative law and how that is going to graft on to our criminal sentencing. And this is kind of harkening back to this discussion that we were having about Kaiser and Stinson and where this is all going to play out. But this is going to come to a head in a couple of years, because we are all left wondering, not only what deference are we going to be supposed to be given to the commentary, which is the Kaiser discussion and the Stinson discussion, but I'm left wondering, what deference are we giving to the guidelines? And there's a difference of opinion out there about whether or not this even plays out in any way. But is there an argument to be made that perhaps the Sentencing Commission, through Loper Bright, is exceeding its authority in some capacity, right? And we shouldn't be giving deference. Now, I'm kind of mixing metaphors with the exceeding its authority, but I do think that this is reflective of an overall attack on agency law and administrative law that we need to be cognizant of in a criminal context.
And just to set the frame of reference for our audience, prior to Loper Bright, Chevron, the so-called Chevron doctrine, which had been the law of the land for decades, essentially afforded deference to administrative agencies, right?
It afforded deference to administrative interpretations of their own regulation, right? And so that is really the question, right? So Chevron's out the window. Well, a reviewing agency interpretation of a statute, courts now have to exercise their independent judgment as to whether an agency acted within its statutory authority. And that's really the question that we're going to have to ask with the Sentencing Commission.
Well, in no other world than in the SEC context that impacts white collar defendants, is it more prevalent, that deference. And the SEC got its wings clipped this term by the Supreme Court in a real way. Talk to us a little bit about some of those SEC cases, because what we've seen come out of the Supreme Court with cases like Jarkissi were really making the authority of the SEC weaker.
Absolutely. I mean, so Jarkissi was an interesting one. That's a fascinating scheme, right? When you think about it, what the SEC had done, which was essentially take their own cases and allow them to be heard in this separate hearing where their conviction rates were through the roof. And so Jarkissi talks about civil penalties in the form of monetary damages are the prototypical common law remedy. And so because of that, they can only be enforced in courts of law, which implicate people's Seventh Amendment rights.
Sounds right to me.
Afforded. Right? I mean, this just seems like such common sense when you think about it. The fact that this agency was able to do this and take the jury trial right away from someone seems such common sense.
I've got some recent experiences with the SEC enforcement apparatus, and I would say the impression I get right now is that they are shoot first, ask questions later. You know, tried and true concepts like the Wells notice process and the interaction that you're supposed to have with the SEC during that process really out the window these days. And they're just coming at people guns blazing, and almost to the facts be damned. They're just really interested in talking facts. So
yeah.
I view cases like Jarkissi as a welcome relief from some overbearing administrative activity at the SEC, enforcement activity at the SEC. But it's clear that we really are having battle lines redrawn when it comes to the administrative enforcement apparatus of any host of these federal agencies. Do you agree?
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think that between Loeffler-Bright and Jarkissi, we are seeing a trend, right? In talking about administrative law and agency authority and what deference we're going to be giving and what power we're going to be giving to agencies to not only decide, but also interpret the law themselves, when really this all needs to rest in the hands of a court of law, an Article III judge, a jury. So I think for criminal practitioners on a larger sense, to go back to what we're talking about, the agency that we deal the most with is the Sentencing Commission. So I think we all need to reflect on how these cases shape our understanding of the Sentencing Commission's authority and whether there is any room for us to challenge that authority and their interpretations in such a way to the benefit of our clients in the criminal sentencing context.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating observation, Morgan. I want you to take out your crystal ball now. Let's talk a little bit about what you see coming down the pike in the future from, I think it would be impossible to survey the circuits, but let's focus on the Supreme Court of the United States, obviously making substantial groundbreaking pronouncements of new law in the most recent term. What do you see coming up in the next term?
So particularly for white-collar practice, as we all know, we're all familiar with the case law surrounding federal mail or wire fraud, right? We're familiar with the line of cases talking about it. And the government likes to get creative when they bring some of these charges and they bring some interesting interpretations of what constitutes criminal conduct under the law. So one case that I'm particularly interested in watching is the Cusesis case, and it comes out of the Third Circuit. And so it deals with whether deception to induce a commercial exchange can constitute wire fraud, even if the defendant does not intend to cause economic harm and the alleged victim in that case still received the good or services that it paid for. So in looking at the filings right now in the Supreme Court, the questions presented, and this was taken from the defendant's petition for a writ of cert, they have identified three issues in that case. And this is kind of based on a circuit split that's developed across the country. So the three issues are, first, like I said, whether deception to induce a commercial exchange can constitute wire or mail fraud, even if inflicting economic harm is not the object. Second, whether a sovereign statutory, regulatory, or policy interest is a property interest when compliance is a material term of payment for goods or services. And then finally, whether contract rights are indeed property. So Cusesis came out of a case involving improper representations from a company for a government contract and whether or not they were using a disadvantaged business enterprise. So they said that they were, and they essentially lied and said that they were, but they still produced and followed through on their end of the contract. So in the government's theory, the government in that case was deprived of what they asked for on their full side of the bargain, so to speak, because they wanted supplies from a DBE, this disadvantaged business enterprise, but they didn't get it, even though they still got the outcome. So that's the question, right? Is that wire fraud? Is that federal wire fraud? And, you know, the court is going to do what we've been talking about, which is they're going to probably go back to basics here. Now, this is just my guess, of course. They're going to go back, fix a statutory interpretation. They're going to rely on the case law, and they're going to see under these principles of statutory interpretation, they may go to some other principles like the rule of lenity. They may look at some federalism principles like they have. They may look at due process to assess this statute and whether the government's interpretation is constitutional and appropriate here.
And this is really part, as you mentioned, a broader narrowing of some of these federal criminal law concepts. I mean, I think we saw this initially with U.S. v. Kelly, when the convictions of the defendants convicted in New Jersey in the Bridgegate case were thrown out because the Supreme Court ruled that the conduct that was alleged didn't violate the wire fraud statute and impermissibly extended the wire fraud statute in a manner that the government have been doing for years. They have been using these tried and true broad statutes like wire fraud to convict a whole sundry of folks. And in U.S. versus Kelly, the Supreme Court said, this has to come to an end. Congress is going to have to specify these laws if they want them to constitute crimes. And you're not going to be able to turn the statutory language on its head to convict people and take away their liberty. I think now's as good a time as ever to preview that on September 18th, coming up, you're going to lead an appellate panel of a discussion on all these types of topics at the Fox Rothschild Third Annual White Collar Symposium in Philadelphia. And present in the room as one of our keynote speakers is going to be Bill Baroni, who actually had his conviction overturned in U.S. v. Kelly. I think it's going to be a fascinating day. To put it mildly, we're going really dissect the legal analysis with the real life story of the man whose life was upended. And
that's exactly right.
And so these have far reaching consequences. Do you think that's a broader trend? I would dare say there's quite a bit I disagree with coming out of this Supreme Court. But I don't disagree with this. I think that the government really has gotten a little over its skis with using some of these broad, platitudinal type of prosecutorial theories built off of statutes that were fully intended to prescribe some different behavior.
I do. That is absolutely right. And I'll tell you that for a couple of reasons. One, I think laws have to be written in such a way so that people know what's criminal, right? So we all can live our lives within the line that Congress tells us. The problem is when those laws can be interpreted by the federal government in such a way that they can get creative to say, this statute is, you know, oh, we can manipulate it to say it would fit this conduct. That's just not an appropriate use of these statutes, whether it's the mail or wire fraud statute or another statute. And that's what the Supreme Court really has been. And they've done this. This is something that we've seen a lot, but this is not a new technique, right? The Supreme Court has particularly reminded us that we cannot trust federal prosecutors to say, oh, I promise I'll enforce the statute as it's written. The Supreme Court has to come in and say, no, this is not right. And then Congress really has to make a law that is clear and that delineate what the appropriate conduct is and what the inappropriate conduct is not.
Amen, from a former federal prosecutor. And so I want to, as we wind down our time together today, Morgan, I want to just really talk a little bit about how the employing at the early stages of a criminal regulatory white collar matter, a lawyer like yourself to observe, preserve, and develop theories of appeal is so critically important. I recently had a success at the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals that was largely driven by proactive thinking about a potential appellate issues that could arise and how to properly frame them. So talk to us a little bit about your role with trial teams, because nobody wants to think about the idea that, well, I'm going to lose, so I need an appellate lawyer. But talk about the proactive appellate lawyer's role as part of the trial team, because that is a tremendous benefit since you've joined the firm that we can now offer our clients.
Absolutely. So I think a lot of people view appellate lawyers, right, as coming in on the backside after something has happened. Either we have to try to fix it or we have to try to protect it. But that sort of responsive appellate lawyer, although is important, I think that there's a use for an appellate lawyer as part of a trial team. And what we've talked about today is a really wonderful example of that. When you get an appellate lawyer who's a part of the trial team, they can take these big picture issues and map them onto your case. So when you are getting ready to decide if you're going to take a plea or go to trial or have a suppression motion, or even if you're at the back end and you have sentencing, you can raise these arguments. Whether it's an initial argument that the conduct doesn't even fall within the statutory interpretation, whether it's a constitutional argument like we saw in Chatry with the geofence warrant, whether it's a sentencing argument, as we have now seen in Erlinger with a bifurcated trial for a jury finding these predicate offenses. Having an appellate lawyer at the very beginning can guide big picture issues that you can be sure to raise. And frankly, if you have success with the big picture issues at the outset, that will shape the rest of the case in a very positive way, to put you in an even better footing for the inevitable appeal that will follow.
We're speaking here today with Morgan McCall Reese, a new member of our white collar team at Fox Rothschild. And in the waning moments here, why don't you just give us a little bit on your background? I touched on it earlier, but just for our audience's sake, tell us a little bit about the experience and the practice that you now bring to the table here at the firm, joining us from the government after quite a career.
Yes, I spent almost a decade as a prosecutor, both here in state court in North Carolina in two different counties. Charlotte was one of them, and then another smaller county. And then after that, I transitioned over to the U.S. Attorney's Office, where I was just a line prosecutor. I was a special AUSA for a little bit, and a line prosecutor prosecuting a variety of crimes, focusing on drugs and guns. And then I focused at the end of my time with the U.S. Attorney's Office solely on criminal appeals. So I've had the opportunity to do a number of briefs, several oral arguments, And I'm taking that time to now flip it on its head and use my knowledge for the greater good.
I like it. I like it, Morgan. And as we expand across the country with this practice, it's terrific to have you as a tremendous resource for our group. And I know we're going to have many matters together in the years ahead. So that's all the time we have here today on the Presumption of Innocence. But until next time, I'm your host, Matt Adams. We'll see you. Take care. Bye-bye.